Journalists of color have been saying it for years. President Trump's rhetoric is dangerous. So why did it take a violent insurrection at the Capitol for much of the mainstream media to listen? It's The Takeaway for Thursday, January 14th, 2021. And we're talking about lessons learned and the way forward for U.S. media. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, more Americans have turned to alcohol to cope during the pandemic, and studies say it's especially true for women. You've been telling us your stories.
The silver lining of the COVID for me was that it really was a wake-up call that my relationship with alcohol was really just not helping me.
Plus, Kemp Powers on his influence as a Black filmmaker in this moment.
As a Black public figure, I think a lot of us are often wondering, questioning, dealing with the issue of, like, what, if any, social responsibility do we have to our greater community?
In the wake of last week's violent insurrection in the Capitol, some mainstream media outlets are finally coming to terms with what many journalists, especially those of color, have been saying all along. President Trump's rhetoric is dangerous. So dangerous, in fact, that it incited an insurrection. These warnings have stood in stark contrast with a National Press Corps that has, for much of the past 4 years, been reluctant to call the president's lies, lies. Despite Trump's long record of incendiary false racist statements, many journalists have struggled to call him out, all in the name of, quote, objectivity and covering, quote, both sides. And that's whether Trump was calling white supremacists in Charlottesville
very fine people on both sides,
or referring to the coronavirus as
Kung Flu,
or calling the insurrectionists
very special
and telling them
we love you.
At the same time, the media landscape is also different than it was 4 years ago. While Fox News has continued to dominate television news, we've witnessed the growth of even more extreme pro-Trump outlets like Newsmax, One America News Network, and Sinclair Broadcast Group. And these networks, along with social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and Parler, have played a role in radicalizing millions, deepening the divide in the nation. So where do we go from here, and what has the mainstream media learned, and how does it avoid making those mistakes as we move ahead? That's where we begin today. Matt Gaertz is a senior fellow at Media Matters, and Maya King is a politics reporter at Politico, and they both join me now. Matt, Maya, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Maya, let's start with you. I guess this, the only way to put this is, why did it take a violent insurrection for more journalists to fully come to terms with the danger of Donald Trump?
That really is the question. And it's easy to say, I think, that reporters, particularly those of color who had been saying that this president stokes violent behavior, are feeling vindicated in this time. But I don't think that's the full picture. I mean, we look back at the events in Charlottesville that you mentioned, and I think that there was an element of sort of not taking the threat of white supremacist violence very seriously, because those who were storming Charlottesville were carrying tiki torches and wearing Hawaiian shirts. And then between that time and now, we really learned that those themselves were symbols of hatred, and that these movements were only growing more sophisticated and really gaining more manpower from 2017 to 2020. And it was only being further stoked again by the president's words and by his calling into question the results of the election. And the media, you know, as it continued to grow and mature, I think was having a hard time actually giving credence to just how serious this threat was. And now here we are, about 8 days after one of the most violent domestic terror attacks I think this country has ever seen. And it's forced the media to really be more aggressive in calling these things what they are, calling the president and the things that he says racist, and calling his lies lies. These were things that we were once very uncomfortable with doing, that now, in order to get the story right, and I think even to make sure that people's lives are protected and that they understand the scope of the situation, it's something that we absolutely have had to do. It's just now feeling like it was a bit delayed, because we also know that this president has less than a week left in his term.
So many things about the reaction to what's happening feel delayed right now, Maya. That's a great word for it. Matt, I'm curious about, you know, we're hearing, you know, this conversation is happening, like, as Maya pointed out, just days before the president leaves office. Why has it taken so long? I mean, I think about my own experiences in reporting on race, but I also recall my former colleague Farai Jadea tweeting about her experiences for years as a Black journalist, trying to tell stories about white nationalism and having editors say no. What is the issue here? I mean, was it largely the editors in newsrooms that were uncomfortable with these stories, Matt?
It's a great question, you know, and clearly journalists of color and Jewish journalists have been much more focused on the real danger posed by Donald Trump than others in political journalism. I mean, I think part of it is the degree to which the reporters have skin in the game, so to speak, the degree to which they are personally endangered by the prospect of the rising power of white nationalism and of authoritarianism in the United States. I think absent that direct risk, too many journalists were willing to turn away from what was happening around them. I think another part of it is a sort of ideological commitment to the notion that there are two sides to every question in American politics, and they are both equally valid. There's one on the left and one on the right, and you need to go get comments from both sides and put them into your article, and the truth is somewhere in between. I think that that has historically been a very powerful force in political journalism and a real motivating force, and that as the asymmetric radicalization of the Republican Party took place, I think journalists were often slow to realize what was happening and react to it.
I struggle with that, even though, Matt, I know that you're accurate in saying that. And Maya, I'm struggling with that because it wasn't all journalists who said that this was a problem, who pointed out that these issues, you know, are serious and should be taken seriously. What does this tell us, Maya, about news media leadership over the past couple of years? Because at the end of the day, everyone in this conversation knows you could have a great idea, but unless it's green lit by a higher ranking journalist, it won't be printed or make it to the airwaves.
I think that we can look back on some of the editorial decisions that were made, especially before 2020, where we absolutely had to be more aggressive in calling out lies and calling out the legacy of systemic racism, that there was almost, I think this move to kind of tiptoe around a lot of these issues. And you're right, you know, these stories are so important to be told, but if you can't get them greenlit, then, I mean, they're good as nothing. And, you know, it's hard to even feel comfortable enough to pitch these really important stories. One change, though, that I think I've observed was in the immediate aftermath of the insurrection, hours after insurrectionists stormed the Capitol, we saw a lot of stories that highlighted the double standard in policing and in how police and law enforcement reacted to the white nationalist mob that actually stormed the Capitol and put many elected officials' lives in danger. There was a lot less force used there than over the summer of protests with Black Lives Matter and predominantly Black activists that were in the streets calling out these very same issues. And I think that, you know, I'm not saying that 4 years ago this might not have been called out and that there might not have been these stories told, but the immediacy with which they were called out and the ways that newsrooms immediately were able to recognize this double standard, I think reflects a level of growth there. And I'm also, you know, I think it also reflects the larger platform that Black activists have had in the past year, because that's another group of people who have absolutely been calling this out and calling out the president's words as dangerous and a reflection of what, you know, could potentially harm their own communities. But they didn't really have as large of a platform in the news media to really be able to be used as sources and be able to tell these stories really until very recently. And the summer of protests last year really brought to light a lot of these issues.
Matt, I'd love if you could give us a sense of the arc, the narrative arc that we've seen in terms of news outlets, at least mainstream news outlets that cover or have attempted to cover white supremacy and the growth of these groups of insurrectionists and militias on the ground. Initially, I feel like it very, very early on, there were almost flattering profiles of some of the folks who were leading the quote-unquote alt-right. How has that evolution happened over the course of the past 4 years?
I think that what we have seen is a growing understanding among journalists that the violent white nationalists who have gained increasing numbers and gained increasing influence over the course of Donald Trump's administration are really dangerous, and that they are directly connected in frightening ways to this administration. I think there's been a lot of really good work done about the relationship that Stephen Miller, a top White House advisor, has to some of these groups. I think in the early days of the administration, there was this sense that these white nationalists were kind of a joke and not really something to worry about. But as we've seen more and more right-wing violence over the last 4 years, from Charlottesville to the El Paso mass shooting to the Trump superfan bomber in 2018 to the insurrection at the Capitol, that has been, I think, impossible to maintain. And so you are now seeing much more centering of the notion that this is a real and growing threat.
Maya, what do you see as far as the coverage itself? I mean, do you think it's gotten better over the course of the past couple of years?
I think we have improved, and I think a large reason why is because we've prioritized a number of the stories that you mentioned earlier that might have actually been passed over or not viewed as very serious or even as political stories. I think, of course, we have a long way to go, and I would love to see more profiles of Black voters and Native American voters and Asian Americans, over, I think, a special attention to a number of the insurrectionists or white nationalists. I think that we've done a very good job of understanding this president and the kind of hateful rhetoric that he stokes and the tensions around race that he stokes. But we haven't yet really dug into understanding the impact of these policies and of these words on the communities that he's targeting. So, it's, of course, a very long process, but I'm much more encouraged now than I was even this time last year.
And of course, this also turns the spotlight on newsroom, quote unquote, diversity, Matt. How have newsrooms done on that? And we'll get into this more in the next segment, but we've got about a minute left now.
I think we are seeing a sort of generational shift in the media. We are seeing more hirings of journalists of color in sort of the entry-level positions. I think it'll take some time for those journalists to move up the pipeline until we see more of that at the top editorial ranks. It is a long-term process, I would say.
Matt, let's talk a little bit about the explosion in conservative and right-wing media. How have the messages coming from those media, and I'm thinking particularly Fox and other outlets that we mentioned at the top, really influenced what we saw last week?
Well, I think the purpose of the right-wing media is to keep the Republican base in sort of a constant state of frothing rage. I mean, its most powerful and prominent figures are constantly warning their audiences that liberals are trying to destroy them and their way of life. This sort of apocalyptic rhetoric, this unhinged fear-mongering is what creates their audiences. It's what keeps them coming back for more. It's what makes the people who practice this sort of rhetoric rich and famous. And so, in the weeks since the election, hosts at Fox News and OAN and Newsmax, have been lying to their viewers. They've been telling them the election was rigged and stolen, that Donald Trump was the rightful president, that there had been effectively a coup by the Democrats against him. It's been a real constant drumbeat across all of these networks and across the platforms of their colleagues in right-wing media. And, you know, if you tell enough people that, some of them are going to believe you and they're going to take action. I think that's what we saw last week. You know, according to NBC News, Ashley Babbitt, who's the rioter who was killed while trying to storm the House chamber, was a, quote, loyal Fox News watcher, according to thousands of tweets to Fox News hosts. And she then, you know, sort of descended through the right wing echo chamber into QAnon conspiracy theorists. This stuff is toxic and dangerous. It's really prevalent across a vast swath of right-wing media, and it does lead to this sort of violent insurrection and terrorism.
Maya, what about you? I mean, how has the tone of conservative media, in your mind, really sort of made our jobs in many ways more difficult? Because really, we're confronting misinformation and disinformation on a daily basis at this point.
And I think that's exactly where it makes our jobs a little bit more difficult, because one, you have the growing number of Americans who are watching these news channels and believing a lot of the mis and disinformation that's being put forth. And then our job, of course, is to try to go back and correct the record, or at least present the most accurate form of information. And it's really difficult, I think, when you're also going against a White House that is continually discounting a lot of the things that we're reporting to try to correct the record or to present the most accurate picture, even if that makes the president or his administration look less than favorable. And I think it gets at, you know, the larger difficulty and the opportunities for growth, really, in this news environment now. We've had to be confronted with lies. And we've had to, I think, a number of political journalists do the really uncomfortable thing of saying that the president of the United States is lying about something, and that it's endangering a number of Americans through this lack of truth. And it's forced us really again to revisit this idea of what the truth is, and make sure that we're presenting the clearest picture possible. But the rise of mis and disinformation, I think, really cannot be overstated here. And especially its danger and what it causes. I think we can look at the events of January 6th as one of the more extreme manifestations of that.
Matt, what about journalists who don't say things, who allow, and I could tell you on this show, we have very specific, you know, requirements as far as what's allowed to be aired in terms of some things that are truthful versus things that aren't truthful. I think of journalists' role to call out the lies. And I've seen some journalists sort of struggle with that and allowing people to have a point of view, but not really challenging that point of view in the name of, quote unquote, fairness.
I think this has been a problem throughout the Trump administration in particular, because we know that President Trump is a liar. We know that he lies constantly on issues big and small. You know, it is far beyond the sort of casual falsehoods that you see from a typical politician. It's really the heart of his political project. It's trying to create this sort of alternate reality fantasy world in which he is the source of truth, and the media and everyone else are the ones telling the lies. And so I think journalists had a great deal of trouble adjusting to that. I think there was a lot of good reporting that happened on the individual lies, but the degree to which they were really willing to incorporate that, the fact that the president was a liar, into their daily work, to really consider before writing a headline that amplified what the president had said, whether or not what he had said was true or not, was a real challenge for them. And one, I think, that was not to their credit over the course of the last 4 years.
Matt Gaertz is a senior fellow at Media Matters, and Maya King is a politics reporter at Politico. Matt and Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
From
From the earliest days of the pandemic, social media has been flooded with jokes and memes about turning to alcohol to cope. But 10 months later, many are reevaluating their relationship to alcohol in a very serious way, some spurred on by the popularity of so-called Dry January. And studies have shown that people are indeed drinking more during COVID-19, but the change is most dramatic in women.
Holly Whitaker is the CEO of the recovery company Tempest and the author of Quit Like a Woman, The Radical Choice Not to Drink in a Culture Obsessed with Alcohol. Holly, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Kamala Green Genese is a clinical psychologist specializing in addiction who works at Partnership to End Addiction and Whole View Wellness. Welcome, Kamala.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Holly, how different does drinking in the United States look now versus before the pandemic?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, I think that we've been taught to not deal with uncomfortable, groundless situations. And so we don't have the tools necessary to deal with an endless state of not knowing what's going to happen, of loss. We turn to alcohol because we are conditioned to turn to alcohol. And so I think that's just it. First, we were flooded with images of using alcohol as a coping mechanism, and that normalized it at the beginning without talking about any of the downsides of it. And then I also think that there is, I mean, I know from my own drinking, there was a way to control it with having to break up my day. And I think that another thing that we're facing that's really interesting is a blur of time where 9 a.m. can feel like 12 p.m., can feel like 4 p.m. And there's no demarcation and it blurs together. And therefore, we drink at times where, you know, we may not have been drinking before. And I could go on.
Kamala, what about the use of alcohol in women specifically, off of what Holly was saying, given everything else that the pandemic has wrought? Why women in particular?
Well, again, I certainly support everything that Holly is saying. I think what we saw even before the pandemic, what we're seeing is an exacerbation of an unfortunate trend. Women in general have been increasing their level of drinking over time, and much of this is due to societal pressures, sort of women taking, you know, sort of on what we would see as sort of non-traditional gender roles, moving into more powerful positions and taking on this idea, unfortunately, so I can drink like a man. I can work like a man and I'm going to start drinking like a man. And unfortunately, that has been supported, as Holly was alluding to, by our society, by the alcohol marketing industry to sort of enhance their sales. Now, in terms of the pandemic, as women have taken on increasing amounts of childcare, amounts of homeschooling, the pressures have only gotten worse. And as Holly was alluding to, there have not been structured ways and people have not been taught ways and how to deal with stress, anxiety, tension in productive, healthy ways. And so women are just facing higher levels of stress, tension related to increased home activities and increased sort of role enhancement as a result of having to do all of these other things in the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Kamala, why... beyond this being a coping mechanism, we should be clear that we're not just talking about people having an extra glass of wine. We're talking about people who are really, I think, going beyond, right? Feeling maybe there's something they should be looking at. Is there a word for that? Is it binge drinking? Is it, what is it exactly?
I mean, it can take on a variety of different forms. I think we do see, in particular, an increase of binge drinking, but I think what we are seeing is, again, as Holly was alluding to, that previously, I mean, one of the things that can help people, even if they have a predisposition or they may be leaning towards drinking more than they should, is structure in one's life, you know, life role sort of, you know, sort of things that would bring them to sort of have to stay within control. And when those things are ripped away, oftentimes sort of people lose their ability to recognize the impact that alcohol may be having in their lives. And so one of the real points that I want to make and I want to stress is that this is really an opportunity, I think, for women, but certainly everyone into society, to really look at how in which we address coping with stress, coping with particular issues that we have never really focused on as a society in a larger way. And so I think that as there was sort of a societal push to just kind of shove towards our easy way of coping with things, which is alcohol, this is an opportunity for us to take a step back and sort of say, we need to build in additional mental health and emotional structures that can help people during this time.
Holly, to Kamala's point about stress, why are women in particular drinking more? And I'm going to preface this by saying we know that hundreds of thousands of women have been pushed out of the workforce since the pandemic began. Women have also had to take on largely dual or triple responsibilities at home if they continue to work. Are those some of the issues that are affecting this increase in women drinking and during the pandemic?
Yeah, I think what Kamala was saying earlier is that we have all of these roles that we've picked up, right? So entering into the workforce, maintaining our emotional labor, caretaking labor, and then also having other unattainable things thrown on us, like body image, body size, beauty standards and ideals. You know, we're supposed to, we keep collecting things that we're supposed to be. And we don't necessarily have the ability to set boundaries, to say no. And so I think when you look at women specifically, you're looking at the continuation of basically picking up things that we're supposed to be responsible for. And then we're also sold a very specific message around alcohol, the same way we were mommy's little helper, that this is a thing that helps us to manage. It's a good thing. And it will help us to homeschool. It will help us to cook. It will help us to date. It will help us to connect. And so we have,
I mean,
basically
Holly,
these
I see
two
these
images.
Things with like moms in particular and mom culture, yes. And it being wine o'clock and mom, yes. Juice and all of that. I mean, that's sort of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, moms are a targeted demographic. I mean, they're they're basically told this is how you parent. This is how you deal with it.
Kamala, your thoughts on that, on how women are targeted specifically with these types of memes and marketing language?
Again, it's sort of a subversive kind of a dance where on the one hand, we're sort of sold, as Holly was saying, these sort of unattainable images and sort of roles that hardly anyone could live up to. But we're going to market to you this you know, substance that will, you know, in many ways is a toxic substance that will help you deal with a role that is maybe too much for you. And if we look, what we're seeing is a crashing of those two concepts at a time when people are really unable to deal with it anymore. With the pandemic and all the political issues that are going on, it has risen it to a level that has become almost unsustainable.
Mm-hmm. We just heard a caller who talked about sort of identifying, you know, realizing that she didn't want to keep drinking and sort of working to do that. What are some of the ways that you see, particularly in this moment when so many of us are isolated and sometimes the drinking is not happening on a Zoom happy hour, it's happening behind closed doors without other folks maybe present to be able to say, hey, maybe that's a, you know, you might want to look at that. How should people be thinking about identifying when they feel that they've, you know, maybe gone too far with their alcohol consumption?
I mean, I think it takes, as the caller did very poignantly described, you know, a radical honesty in terms of the role that alcohol is playing in your life and really taking a step back and looking about, is it adding all of the magical things that we are taught and see in marketing, or is it taking away? And again, using that caller's story, I think she began to recognize it was either interfering with her ability to exercise, or it was interfering maybe with her emotional functioning or her weight. You know, it could have been any number of things. And so it's really in a non-judgmental, non-stigmatized way. Just as we are marketed alcohol in a positive way, we are also taught taking a look at your alcohol consumption is a stigmatized process. And so one of the things I think that is really critical to look at is that, and we're also sold that people that have problems, quote unquote, with alcohol only look a particular way. That could not be more of a misnomer and something that our society has to correct. The majority of people that have difficulties with alcohol and other substances are not what we see in the movies. It's not what we see as people, quote unquote, have hit rock bottom. It's people that on a day-to-day basis are making decisions that are not in their best interest in their use of substances. And we are not socialized as a society to take a step back and look at that in a loving, caring way, just as if you said, wow, I'm going to start eating more broccoli today. And no one would judge you for that. But if you say, I'm going to take a step back and look at the role that alcohol plays in my life, there's a lot of stigma and shame associated with that. So for individuals now, I want people to, you know, actively be able to say that out loud in a way that is, and again, this is where I think Holly comes in so powerfully, in a way that is empowering, in a way that is you know, sort of loving in a way that is sort of a way of taking care of yourself, rather than something that is stigmatized. And there are very specific strategies and things that can people engage in. Yes, it is more difficult during the pandemic, but I think developing sort of mental, emotional, relational strategies of coping are things that are available to us even during this difficult time.
Holly, let's talk about that, because Chrissy Teigen recently revealed on social media that she had committed to moderating her drinking and being sober with the help of your book. And I'm wondering if you can lay out the principles in the book, particularly for women who want to rethink their relationship with alcohol.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I don't think she even talked about managing her drinking. I mean, that still is like a pretty traditional way of thinking about it. She chose sobriety. She chose to remove alcohol, and she did it in a way that did not involve, hey, I have all this shame, I have a problem, I'm going to fit. Like, she actually came into this and talked about the benefit of not drinking. And I think that's one of the biggest flips in this, which is that we think that, oh no, if I go overboard or if I take this too far, if there's something wrong with me, then I'm not going to get to do this thing anymore, get to ingest a toxic, addictive substance. And the way that I frame it and the way that we frame it at Tempest is by specifically saying you don't have to do this anymore. I think that's one of the biggest flips. We don't understand. We're enculturated and indoctrined into drinking culture. We're in a culture that normalizes it the same way we were in a culture that normalized smoking, you know, 50 years ago. And we have choices that we don't understand that we have. Our belief system is such an important part of this. And if we think we're missing out, or if we think that not being able to drink is a flaw or a sign of a pathology or something that's wrong with our genetic makeup, then it's a very different situation than, oh, I don't want to put this thing in my body anymore. And so we work on normalizing the conversation around drinking. This is why things like Dry January are so desperately important, because it starts to normalize that a lot of us struggle, and a lot of us are on a spectrum of abuse. We're not just alcoholics and normal people. There are people that are ingesting a toxic addictive drug on a spectrum of addiction.
Holly, let's talk about that spectrum, because I think that's really important to sort of Kamala's point earlier, which is the stereotype of what we think the quote unquote alcoholic in movies looks like. What's the spectrum? Yeah.
The spectrum is that it's an addictive substance, and people can be abusing it in a way where it's just not like it's a glass a night. It's a habit forming substance. A glass a night can feel terrible to somebody. You don't have to qualify it as an addiction. And that's what we have historically done. We've looked to, are you an alcoholic? Okay, you're not, then keep drinking. And what we have the opportunity to do now is say, do I like how this substance shows up in my life, or do I not like it? And if I don't like it, am I going to make changes around it?
Instead of having a label, you're saying?
Well, I mean, it's not even about the label. The label keeps us focused on a label versus how it's showing up in our lives. And that's exactly what Kamala was saying. She was saying it's this radical honesty that we have to have with ourselves, not, you know, do we qualify?
Holly Whitaker is the author of Quit Like a Woman, The Radical Choice to Not Drink in a Culture Obsessed with Alcohol. And Dr. Kamala Green Genesee is a clinical psychologist specializing in addiction. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's question couldn't have come at a better time. I just brought up my drinking this past week to my therapist, because I am becoming concerned that in the last few months my drinking has increased. I am aware of this. I don't want to continue this behavior. I don't think it's healthy. I think there's better ways to cope, but it does just make me feel a little bit better. I miss seeing everybody, and drinking was something that I did socially, but now I'm doing it more alone. I just don't want it to get any worse.
Hi, I'm Tracy from Salisbury, Connecticut. So at the start of the pandemic, I went from being a pretty heavy drinker one or two times a week to being a light to moderate drinker every single day. And I also stopped exercising. So in the summer, as I started to really settle into the reality of the pandemic and the fact that it was going to go on for a while, I realized that with no social events on the calendar and a desire to just really be sharp at my new job, it was like a really unique and perfect opportunity to make this long overdue change. So my goal was to have a sober October, but come November 1st, I just kept it rolling, and I'm really happy I did.
My relationship to alcohol didn't change much once COVID hit the US, mainly because I had stopped drinking alcohol about 3 or 4 years before then. During lockdown, I saw some more of like the true colors really behind these alcohol companies, in that they took this as an opportunity to sell, which I found appalling and disgusting, and really helped me understand that those who struggle with alcohol, it's not all our fault.
I just wanted to share that after I was laid off in March, I went from being sort of functionally alcohol dependent to being very dysfunctionally alcohol dependent. But a friend of mine told me about an online group called the 30-Day Alcohol Experiment, run by Annie Grace. And I started that 26 days ago, and I'm feeling better than I have in many, many years. And I have tried to moderate my drinking in the past and never had much luck. But I have to say that the silver lining of the COVID for me was that it really was a wake-up call for me that my relationship with alcohol was really just not helping me in any way.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I was relying on alcohol for like Fridays, as if I was going to like happy hour or things like that. But it didn't really increase. I was really aware of that. I tried to keep it that much even in the summer, although I have to say that during the holidays, I was drinking a little bit more, but I've decided that even if we go into full lockdown this year, I am not going to drink. So far, so good.
My name is Barrett from San Diego, California. I deliver food for one of the delivery apps. My personal relationship to alcohol has not made a dramatic change since the pandemic began, and I've watched it increase. I start early in the morning and people begin ordering alcohol from liquor stores and a lot of alcohol with their breakfast or brunch. And this is 7 days a week. It seems to be a side effect of the pandemic.
And we're going to round out the hour today with the voice of a filmmaker who's already having a very successful 2021, Kemp Powers. Powers is the co-director and co-screenwriter for Pixar's newest film, Soul, which premiered at the end of last month. Powers is also the screenwriter on another major release, One Night in Miami, which he adapted for the screen from his own play and which marks the directorial debut of actor Regina King. The film taps into Powers' interest as a self-described history buff. It was inspired by a brief section he came across in a book about sports and the civil rights movement of the 1960s, detailing what happened after Muhammad Ali won a fight to become heavyweight champion of the world on February 25th, 1964.
No one expected him to win except close friends. So afterwards, rather than go and party in Miami Beach, he retreated to the still segregated black part of town, where he spent the night in quiet conversation with several friends in a room. And those friends were Malcolm X, football player Jim Brown, and singer Sam Cooke. And the next morning is when he spoke to the press and told them that he was officially a member of the Nation of Islam. And so my mind just went wild. I'm imagining what kind of conversation must have happened in that room.
Powers spent more than 2 decades working in journalism, and he initially envisioned writing a nonfiction book about this night before taking the work in a different direction.
I kind of set about doing a lot of research into just the friendship between those four men, a friendship that blossomed over several years around this night. And the thing that stymied me and prevented me from ever writing that book was the fact that I couldn't quite piece together what they said, many details of what they said in the room, other than like they had bowls of vanilla ice cream. But when I started moving into playwriting, the very thing that had stymied me in terms of writing the book, which was not knowing what happened in the room, really provided a great platform for what I saw as a perfect theatrical work, just using these men and who they were and their experiences to create these characterizations of them to have a discussion that I feel has been going on in the Black community for many years before that and all the years since then.
The movie explores the relationship or the responsibility that these men felt that they had to support other Black Americans. And there's an interesting tension between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke in terms of their approaches. Why did you see the two of them as being at odds with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think in reality, probably wouldn't have been that directly at odds. But I think that their philosophies, their central philosophies about how to progress as a people, when you really look at it, they're kind of like they're very different methods. I mean, Sam Cooke was an incredibly shrewd businessman who figured out how to work within the system that's of the music industry to bring about change. And Malcolm X, through his speeches, was obviously very confrontational and about like change now, change at all costs, change by any means necessary. So these two kind of warring ideas, which are honestly neither one of them is the right concept for every situation. It's very situational. There are definitely times when we have to be confrontational and change has to happen and change has to happen immediately. And there's other times when, you know, it's you can bring about more lasting change by working within an established structure. So I just wanted to kind of bring to life that debate. It's a debate that's been going on for a long time. And as a Black artist, as a Black public figure, I think a lot of us are often wondering, questioning, dealing with the issue of like, what if any social responsibility do we have to our greater community? And I think that's a reasonable thing to think about when you are underrepresented in whatever, you know, field you happen to be doing.
You also have another project, which is Pixar's Soul. And you were originally brought onto the film as a screenwriter, but you ended up being a co-director. Tell me how your role ended up expanding. I mean, this is Pixar's first lead Black character, so that's a really big deal.
All Pixar films begin with a pitch and a concept from the director. And in this case, it was director Pete Docter who came up with the idea for what would become Soul. And at the point at which they decided to make the main character a Black jazz musician, I think that was when they figured, okay, it's time to bring in a new writer, collaborator, to make sure that in executing this story, you know, it, the character, his development gets the attention that it needs. And that's when I was brought in. That was about 2 years into the process. And for those who don't know, animated films take between 4 and 8 years. So it was a ways into the process, but still fairly early on. So I came in as a writer. But then soon after I started, in addition to writing, Pete definitely wanted my input in lots of areas outside of writing, things ranging from character design to the set design to the casting of the film to kind of being a vocal part of the internal and external culture trusts that were formed of consultants and employees around the film. And as I took on more and more jobs, Pete decided that, you know, having me just as a writer or writer plus wasn't enough. And that's when he asked me to be co-director and to help him finish the whole film.
And we mentioned the fact that Soul is has Pixar's first Black lead character. Again, to think about the fact that we're in 2021 and we're still having firsts when it comes to Black people, people of color more broadly in animation and even in Hollywood across the board, it's sort of surprising. But when you were working on this, I mean, how did that weigh a lot? Like the pressure of creating Pixar's first Black lead character and how that would be received? Or were you just really involved in the process and figured, you know, we'll see how the audience responds to it?
It weighed on me heavily, but that, and I don't want to make it sound like it was a burden, because it was a burden I was honored and happy to take on, because it was a start. I mean, the interesting thing about Soul is that, look, it's not like Pixar was trying to say that Soul was a Black movie, so to speak. It's a movie. It's the themes of Soul are universal, but our exposure to those themes are through the prism of a Black man, and to me, that's a big deal. To have this universal human story be allowed to be told through the life and experiences of a Black man. So my goal, my approach to it was like, you know, imagine if you're making a film like It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Carol. And those are films that obviously have very, very universal themes, but the main character happens to be Black or happens to be Latino or happens to be Asian. I think that, you know, it's about making sure that the character that's represented up on that screen in his or her world is an authentic character and recognizable to people from that community. So, you know, that was a big part of, I think, our collective responsibility to make sure we got that right. But again, at the end of the day, we were definitely trying to tell a universal story. But I think by being careful and cautious and you know, detailed when it comes to the hyper-specificity, it opens people up to receive that universal story you're trying to give them.
You've now worked in journalism and entertainment, two industries that have had issues with to put it mildly, with inclusivity and diversity and, you know, welcoming and promoting and highlighting people of color and Black artists. And have you seen any changes in Hollywood that make you optimistic about where the industry is going from here?
Yes, I have. I mean, the thing that makes me most optimistic, because look, for example, look at this year. There is just a bumper crop of incredible films that have been created by, not just starring black actors and actresses, but created by Black artists of color, directed by, written by, and in some cases produced by. And I think that speaks to what we need. That's the big improvement, is that it's going up the chain. It's not just about having Black representation in front of the camera. It's about the representation behind the camera, and most importantly, at the decision-making level. You know, I think that you speak about a film like Soul, and people are heralding the fact that there's a Black lead. They're heralding the fact that it's a Black writer and a Black director. They should also be heralding the fact that there was a Black executive producer, Kiri Hart, one of our EPs. And that's a name that people might not be as familiar with, but Kiri's had an illustrious career working at Lucasfilm, and her contributions at the executive level are a big part of how these films that get out to people are, you know, how they look and how they're going to be received. So I definitely would say that there has been improvement, but we always have to be vigilant so that the pendulum doesn't swing the other way and the doors don't swing closed. I'm more optimistic than in the past that the doors won't swing closed, because I think you have seen more representation, though still small, at higher levels in the food chain.
I think your point is also about Soul in particular is, you know, we get there by, you know, creating universal stories with characters of all backgrounds, not just, you know, like you said, a Black animated film, but a film that happens to have a universal theme that also happens to feature Black characters. And I think that's an important way to approach this. Kemp, we're talking to a lot of folks on this show every day, and a lot of the times we're asking them, is there something that they're doing to find some joy or some hope in this terrible moment that we're living in for so many people? I mean, where and how are you finding joy in this moment?
I mean, it sounds really corny, but just like in Soul, I'm finding joy in the little things. I really am. I've been pretty much trapped.
That's not corny, by the way.
Okay. Like, I've been trapped at home for the better part of the past 10 months, and it's given me a lot of time to reflect. It's given me a lot of time to think. It's also given me a lot of time to kind of look back and enjoy different things and kind of introduce new things into my life. I'm just trying, it's given me time to reconnect with people that I haven't been able to speak to for many, many years. And all of those things are the gifts that I have to see them as gifts, because, you know, I'm still here. And life itself is really like the biggest gift of all. And it's a troubling time. But I guess I'm lucky because I've written things that are historically centered, and I'm a bit of a history buff. And as troubling as the times we're living through are, we have to remind ourselves that there's been other troubling times again and again and again in the past. And however we come out of them, if we come out of them at all and we're still here, then that's the gift.
Kemp Powers is the screenwriter for One Night in Miami and co-director and co-screenwriter for Pixar's Soul. Kemp, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Everybody, that's all for us today and all for me this week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast, and you can find that at thetakeaway.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, don't forget, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or record a voice memo and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Remember, we want to hear your beautiful voices, so record those thoughts and send them our way. And the crew that makes this show rolls deep, so let me tell you who they are. David Gable is our executive assistant. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Our line producers are Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, and Jason Tureski. Our broadcast engineer is Vince Fairchild. Sham Sundra helped out on the board this week, and Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.